This is The Radical Therapist, a space where we explore the intersections of collaborative therapy, philosophy, art, and science and technology in a post-Freud, post-psychology world.
Welcome to The Radical Therapist. This is your host, Chris Hoff. We are now at episode number 65, and as always, thanks for listening and tuning in. Another wonderful podcast for you today. But before we get there, I have just one quick announcement. In the last week, I wrote an article. I just wanted to let people know about this, so if you're interested, you might want to check it out. But in the last week, I wrote an article on, I'm an active member on Instagram, and if you're not following The Radical Therapist on Instagram, go check it out, The Radical Therapist on Instagram. But, so I get to see a lot of stuff and therapists on Instagram, and I wrote an article. There was a New York Times article recently on therapists as the new poets on Instagram, and then I kind of wrote a response, a critical response to not so much that article, but what I've been seeing on Instagram. And you can find that article on Medium. The title of the article is called The Trouble with Instagram Therapists. The Trouble with Instagram Therapists. If you go on Medium and just search Dr. Chris Hoff or Chris Hoff, you'll be able to find it, or even just Google it. I'm sure it'll come up. It's created a little bit of controversy, so I've had some... judging by the anonymous DMs I've been getting on Instagram. So you might want to check it out. So I think I do a good job of like trying to do a balanced job of looking at the possible good and the good that's happening on Instagram, but also maybe raising some awareness or some critical consciousness about some of the things that are happening on Instagram via psychologists, therapists, social workers, whatever. So if you're interested in that, go check it out on Medium. Just Google my name or Google it. Just Google it. The Trouble with Instagram Therapists by Chris Hoff, and it should come up. So, and there, I actually have some other articles on there too, if you're interested. It's kind of my depository for some of my writing, my blogging. I used to be a pretty active blogger, but not so much. But I kind of want to get back to that soon, hopefully too. So anyway, we have a wonderful show for you today. Somebody that I'm really excited to get on the program, and we're going to be talking with Dr. Sheila McNamee, and very excited about that. And so we'll just get right into it. Sheila McNamee, PhD, is a professor of communication at the University of New Hampshire and vice president of the Taust Institute, which I'm privileged to be a member of. So her work is focused on dialogic transformation within a variety of social and institutional contexts, including psychotherapy, organizations, and communities. She is author of Relational Responsibility, Resources for Sustainable Dialogue with Kenneth Gergen, and Research and Social Change, A Relational Constructionist Approach with Diane Marie Husking, among other books, and has published numerous articles and chapters on social constructionist theory and practice. She actively engages constructionist practices in a variety of contexts, bringing communities of participants with diverse and often opposing viewpoints together to create livable futures. And she's going to share a little bit about how she does that in our program today. So without further ado, let's meet Sheila McNamee. Okay, welcome to the Radical Therapist Podcast, Dr. Sheila McNamee.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me. It's great to be here.
Yes, I appreciate you taking the time. I'm really excited to talk to you about radical presence. I recently, watched a video you did, I think somewhere in Europe, where you were kind of briefly talking about radical presence, and it just really, sparked my interest. And I'm familiar with your work. I've read your work previously as well, and I'm just really glad that we get to have this time now. And I guess to start, I want to start by maybe having you share with our audience a bit about your background and your relational constructionist approach.
Okay, sure. Yeah, thank you, Chris. Well, all right. My background, I actually, my field is communication. It's not family therapy or psychotherapy or psychology. And I really feel privileged about that background, because I think it is exactly what everybody in our community in the broadest sense, you know, whether you're a narrative therapist, a systemic therapist, and any broad range of therapists, we're all like really focused on communication. That's the centerpiece. So that's my training and that's my PhD. I did my PhD research on therapeutic process, actually, because while I was in graduate school, the Milan book, Paradox and Counter Paradox, was published. And I kind of bumped into it as, you know, I found it and I brought it back to my dissertation advisor. I said, look at this really great book. And so that kind of pulled me in. I think I was already quite interested in therapeutic process. And then I actually did a lot of coursework with the family therapy PhD students and did some like cross back and forth during that time period. And, you know, one of it actually was quite formative for the kind of work that I have gone on to do, mostly about how do you coordinate differences and how do you, you know, bring really oppositional views together in some way. And this was good. My graduate training was good training for that because I would be with the family therapy PhD students and in those courses, and I felt like the foreigner. I didn't have the language. And then I would come back to my communication seminars and I'd be using this different language. And then I felt like a foreigner in my quote unquote home. And so I feel like I have lived my entire career in that liminal space between a whole lot of different areas. So for example, when I was being reviewed for tenure at the university, there was this big discussion of whether they should have scholars evaluating my work or have practitioners evaluating my work. And, you know, to me, that was a ridiculous question because my definition is a scholar is or should be a practitioner, and a practitioner is a scholar. So so there's always been that kind of tension for me, which is a good tension. It's a positive thing. The relational constructionism, really, I mean, I think as an undergraduate, I was really influenced by Berger and Luckman's The Social Construction of Reality. And then in my graduate work, studying with Pierce and Cronin, for people who know them, and their coordinated management of meaning theory, it was, you know, very much about constructing realities. I have shifted in the way I language it to relational constructionism because this social construction is, there are two things about it. One is it's rooted in sociology and it's also rooted in academia. So my version, I used to call my version of social construction a radically relational social construction. And then I just dropped that. I guess I've liked the word radical all my life, maybe. I just thought of that.
I get that.
it's a good word. And now I just refer to relational constructionism because it really is about looking at that relational process where some more sociological and traditional approaches to social construction are just looking at the way in which individuals socially construct the world by having input from the broader, you know, social surroundings. So I want, you know, I wanted to make that kind of distinction, although I'm not interested in being the language police around this. You know, I think that a lot of people have very different ideas about what social construction is. And so it's an attempt to kind of define it how I want to define it.
Great. And before we get to the description of radical presence as an alternative to the therapeutic state, I'm wondering if you could describe for the listeners how you view like our contemporary therapeutic state.
Yeah. Well, you know, for me, that term, as you just said, it refers to our current situation, the situation that we live in. Okay, here, everyone, everything is constantly being evaluated, diagnosed, assessed, rated, treated. Even the most simple comment, like "you look great today," becomes an assessment, right? Instead of just a friendly exchange of some sort. So in that way, it reminds me the moment we're living in is like Big Brother. You know, you're always being watched. We're constantly under surveillance from either some person or from some governing body or some, you know, influential body. And there are always the experts who know better, who can do this kind of assessment, diagnosis, and so forth. And so that for me is what the therapeutic state is, that we're living in this moment where that level of constant surveillance and diagnosis and assessment really puts the spotlight on us as individuals and our individual actions and our individual, you know, failings or, you know, what we do well. And we're not looking at the broader picture. We're so closed in on what we focus on that, of course, everything always comes back then to a problem with a person.
Mm. Okay, that was great. What a great description. Could you say more about the psi complex? You've used the word psi complex, which I really like. Industrial complex, but you call it a psi complex. Can you tell us about how you view the psi complex, or how it has us view all the problems we confront in contemporary society, and how it kind of, you know, are traced to those problems are traced to some personal failing or flaw within a modernist individualist view?
Yeah. So, you know, I'd love to take credit for the psi complex, but have to give the credit to Nicholas Rose, of course, who used that term, and I really like it as well. To me, the psi complex and the therapeutic state are one and the same. We can't pull those apart. So, you know, if you accept the premise of individualism or of modernism, which is this dominant discourse that we live amongst, unfortunately, the focus is always on the individual person or the individual action. And there's no concern for the complex relational processes that these people engage in, that we engage in. Mm. Ed Sampson coined, I'm certain it was he who coined the term self-contained individualism, and which it kind of describes this psi complex that we are all seen as separate autonomous beings, and that this skin, this body, is simply a container for everything that makes us who we are. So if I want to understand you, I need to somehow delve deep inside you. And of course, you know, we could talk for hours about all the critiques of how, you know, does a survey or does a question from a therapist really get inside a person? Mm-hmm. We'll never know, you know, and basically all we know is what we do here, what we do together. Okay, so the focus on the self-contained individualism really places our attention on those private aspects of a person, their thoughts, their emotions, their feelings, their motivation, you know, why, what motivates you to do this. And unfortunately, that's become so naturalized that nobody questions it, that it's, and this is the psi complex, you know, that it just goes completely unquestioned as the way the world is. And in some regard, we have to say, oh, I can understand why that is. Not only is this like an age old, very, you know, prominent way of talking, but when we move about in the world, we see separate people. You know, you and I don't bleed into each other. We look like separate atoms, you know, moving around. Mm-hmm. So the problem, though, with the psi complex, of course, is it ignores the broader cultural, social, communal aspects and institutional aspects that we live among. And I'll just give one little example that I always like to give to kind of put an image to this difference between looking at individuals and looking at the process. I have a old friend and colleague who's an engineer, and he's always kind of, you know, giving me a hard time about what I do. It's, you know, soft and touchy-feely and so forth. And so one night at a dinner party, I said, you know, well, tell me, explain your research to me. And he said, oh, it's very simple. Of course, I study the transfer of heat. And so I put two objects on the lab table, and then I put this apparatus on, And once I put this apparatus on, over my eyes, I cease to see the two objects. All I see is the movement of energy, heat between them. And I said, well, you know what? We do the same thing. So that's, for me, that imagery is really important because, you know, how can we train ourselves, invite ourselves to stop seeing these atomized individual aspects? The psi complex is, you know, puts it right there. That's all we're looking at is you and what's going on with you.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so you, let me go here. You, in your work, you also write that when an individual is working on his or her problems, their problems, with a professional, the common assumption is that the wisest action for those within the close network of relations is to stay away and let the professionals do the work. And I thought that was a nice piece. Could you say more about that?
Yeah. if you think about it, not so many years ago, if you had a problem, a challenge, you might go to your religious leader, or people in your community, or the group, you know, that you associate with, the Masons or whatever, you know, or your family, you turn to your family. People have lived through crisis and trauma for as long as people have walked the earth. And we didn't have experts dealing, you know, to deal with our problems until relatively recently. And now this notion is that, you know, it's not my job, experts have to do it. Okay. This reminds me when I first started working at the University of New Hampshire, a psychologist invited me out to lunch and she was asking me what my PhD research had been on. And I told her therapeutic process. And she immediately said, well, what makes it that possible for you to have anything to say about therapeutic process? And then she drilled me. Have you ever taken a developmental psychology course? Have you ever taken an abnormal psychology course? Have you ever taken, you know, and she listed it. And it's that mentality that only the people with the right credentials can be helpful people. Right. And, to me that epitomizes what counts as a qualified expert, and it completely ignores those, depends on the degree, it could be natural or not so naturally cultivated relations that people acquire through living a life. I think we need to step away from just let the experts do their work and don't mess it up.
Agreed. So going beyond that, you propose a movement beyond the therapeutic state that you've come to call a radical presence. And I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
Yeah. So let me explain where that came from for me in the first place. I was getting more and more annoyed with the popularity of mindfulness. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with all due respect to people who do mindfulness work, the word out there in the culture at large is a very individualized notion of mindfulness. You know, you learn to meditate, you get into your own thoughts, you get in tune with yourself. And this was my attempt to kind of take that, the same good parts of mindfulness practice and the mindfulness literature, but put it into relational terms. So that's where I came up with radical presence. Because I wanted to focus on relational processes and not mental states of individuals. So radical presence to me means being attentive to the process of relating itself. So in other words, being really responsive to another, being open to question your own beliefs and assumptions, being completely open to the unfolding nature of an interaction. I mean, oftentimes we go into an interaction, particularly in the old days with even Milan family therapy, you know, you had a hypothesis, you had questions, you had an idea of what was already happening, and you generated, you know, not intentionally, but could generate very easily a conversation with clients that produced confirmation of your story. So for me, radical presence is, you know, we all have our stories, we all have our judgments, we all have our beliefs, but to hold them at bay And really, instead of being frustrated by the ongoing, unfolding, unknowing aspect of interactions, to really be joyful about that, that those moments are where creativity and innovation emerges, because you haven't already predefined where you want to go. It's not an easy place to be in, I don't think, but it's important.
Right. Okay, so you've spoken about how our helping professions, the training programs for therapists and counselors, et cetera, have trained the relational out of those seeking to help. And I'm wondering, what can be done differently? How can we support the relational rather than the strong focus on techniques or interventions or even individualized practice that you were talking about earlier?
To quote Nancy Pelosi, I have a plan for that. So I've thought a lot about this, and, you know, because I've also had training as a family therapist, and what strikes me is that let's start with the assumption, it's faulty in some ways, but probably generally true, that most people who go into the helping professions do so because they have had a life of people coming to them and saying, "You're so helpful. You always help me, you know, and I love talking to you. I get so much out of it." So let's just assume that most people are like that who go in for some kind of helping profession training, or let's call it therapeutic training. Mm-hmm. And the first thing that happens in these training programs is you're introduced to various theories and models and methods.
Right.
My plan would be for the first 6 months or maybe even a year to take trainees and put them every week into different triads where there's an interviewer, an interviewee, and an observer. Hmm. And the interviewee presents a challenge, doesn't have to be, you know, serious, just anything in their life, little something happening. And the interviewer just interviews and the observer takes notes. And then the trio has a conversation, you know, what for the interviewee, what questions or comments were helpful? What really didn't help? For the interviewer, like, what did you feel really comfortable about here and so forth? And what did the observer observe? And you do this for several months in different triads. And what you're doing there generally is then creating a catalog, if you will, of the resources that you have cultivated over the course of your life to help people. And you've tweaked them and used them in different ways with different people around different issues. Then once you feel really solid in resources I can use that are helpful, then you can start learning theories and methods and models. But I think in the way we train now, what happens is the theory, introduction of theory, methods, and models, just it's like Men in Black, you know, you just blanked, everything that you knew before is gone, and you're trying so hard to achieve this epitome. I mean, I remember myself with, I love all Carl Tom's different kinds of circular questions, but I remember in my initial training, you know, sort of like, okay, check, I asked one of those, check, I asked one of those, you know, instead of really being present in this radical way that I'm trying to talk about.
Yeah, that's great. And I love that. I love that you offered up actual praxis, right? And we can get talking about theory all day long, but you have a plan, like you said. And I really appreciate you offering that to us. And that sounds like something we can all experiment with, those of us that are faculty and counseling or therapy programs, that kind of thing. Thank you for that. Okay. You've spoken also of coordinating, I really like this piece of coordinating multiple ways of being rather than trying to figure out the right way to be. And I'm wondering if you could say a little bit more about that.
Yeah. So, we live in a complex world. We live among diversity and difference. So in an attempt to try to figure out the right way forward, or who's right or who's wrong, we have to ask the question, by whose standards? Like, who gets to call the shots? The person with more power, usually, right? But so for me, it's not a matter of right or wrong, context free. It's a matter of recognizing that that every belief system, every worldview that is constructed is real, is coherent, and is rational for those people who construct it. And it's a community we're talking about, because, you know, jokingly, I say to my students, you know, I can't just construct like I'm the president of the United States. You know, that gets you hauled off and, you know, to a psychiatric ward. But so we're talking about not people just making things up. We're talking about communities coming together and coordinating their actions. And out of those coordinations, ritualized patterns emerge, which then generate series of expectations of how people should behave, which then lead to like, this is the way it is. Mm-hmm. And every, whether it's a dyad, a whole community, a culture, every group that is engaged in this process of constructing a worldview is doing so in ways that are completely coherent, legitimate, and rational for them. Mm-hmm. So if we start with that premise, then when we confront difference, like let's say difference on abortion, you know, pro-choice, pro-life, instead of saying you're wrong because you don't have my views, asking the question, how did your view emerge, really complexifies the issue and actually opens up my desire to know more, to be curious about, wow, I didn't grow up that way. That's not the way I see things, if you can create that kind of space. So that's what I mean by coordinating multiplicity. How do you create those conversational spaces where people can actually have those kind of difficult conversations, but not with judgment, but with genuine respect for and genuine curiosity to understand. So that's another point for me is like put agreement aside. I'm never interested in agreement. I'm interested in trying to generate new ways of understanding difference. And from there, at least if I don't judge you because you're different and I'm engaged in more of a curious conversation, just trying to understand, you're very likely to stay in interaction with me. And if you're likely to stay in interaction with me, then you and I have a great chance of creating some common understanding later down the line somewhere.
Yeah,
but if we end our interaction, that's not possible.
Yeah, and I think the interaction never even happens. I'm thinking of contemporary times, right, where I think everybody doesn't see agreement happening, so they're not even going to engage. And right. And this idea of you setting aside agreement, that's really, I think, radical as well, right? And then because then it just frees you up in a lot of different ways. That's wonderful. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that comes from people's like, we've got to have an answer. We've got to have an answer. Yep, we can't move forward without an answer. And we can move forward, you know, and we don't need the answer right now. We just need, you know, one step at a time, let it unfold.
Yeah. And somebody's got to be right and somebody's got to be wrong, or, you know, you get caught up in all that stuff. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. That was wonderful. Another thing I really appreciate about your work is its emphasis on leaning into complexity. And so I'm wondering, how do we support those or support this, the leaning into complexity, with those that seek our help or with students we teach or in our even our own communities?
Yeah, it's really hard. I think our knee-jerk response to complexity is to quick try to get an answer or an agreement so that we'll simplify. And I think the sooner we can embrace that the world is not going to get any simpler, it's only going to get more and more complex. When we think about all, just think about the interactions you have yourself in one day. There's so many different ones. And in each one of those, you're creating different ways of understanding the world. And sometimes they're oppositional. So when you're with this group, these are the things that you like, but when you're with that group, it's completely different. So we ourselves harbor this complexity. It's not just us in relation to others. So given the fact that it's not going to go away, if we can embrace it, then we can hopefully generate a tolerance for difference, because we expect it. We don't expect people to all think the same way. You know, we're not like, where did that come from? We say, okay, that's come from somewhere. There's some community of people constructing this. This is why I think a constructionist view is so important. And then we can become, you know, interested in finding out more about the construction of that rather than being, you know, in that immediate space of judging. Well, it's different from me. So, you know, my people, so it can't be possibly be good. You know, if we want others to respect our own views, we need to start with respecting and trying to find out more about other views. And very important in this is that I am not saying that we condone it. So, yeah. You know, I'm not saying, oh, it's okay if you want to kill people, that's fine, that's your belief system. But instead of moving to judgment, first, let's try to understand so we can be in interaction with each other, because once we're in interaction, we can keep the conversation going. And in conversation, in interaction, that's where new meaning emerges. And so the possibility for change is only in keeping that conversation going.
And I know you've spoken to this, but my next question is, you know, you're in the United States with me, and I am as well. And I think it's pretty clear that here we're having a hard time relating with each other, right, in a lot of different ways. And there's a lot of opposing viewpoints. And I guess I'm wondering, how do we really break through? I think people are a little stuck here, right? And I'm wondering, how do we begin to genuinely listen to each other with curiosity? And how do we support these efforts, right?
Yeah, well, I'm not going to suggest it's easy because it's not.
Yeah.
But I do think it's possible. Okay. I honestly do think it's possible. I think, you know, we have to start creating the conditions within which we can listen to each other. We can question each other, and we can suspend our judgment. And unfortunately, all three of those things, listening, questioning, and suspending judgment, are not what we do now.
No, right.
We just attack, right? Mm-hmm. So it's not, you know, I don't want to provide a technique for doing this, which a lot of helping professions offer, a quick fix or technique.
Yeah.
But what I've tried to cultivate over the course of my career is what I like to refer to as fluid and supple resources for action that kind of help us, you know, do that, to listen, to question our own perspective and so forth. And so, like, some of them, they're all very simple things. But one is create the conversational space. You know, we should think long and hard about where's the best place to have a discussion about political differences. Is it at the bar? Probably not. So create the space where people feel welcomed. And we have a lot of examples of that, you know, from our colleagues, like the Public Conversation Project,
right, right.
And things like that, you know, that you can do that. Another resource that I think can be helpful here is to invite people to speak from stories. Again, these are not new ideas. This is what we all have been doing and writing about all these years. But, you know, generally, when there are differences, people are invited to speak from their position, right? But a position is an abstraction. A story, I could disagree with your position, but if I hear how you came to that position, I may still disagree with the position, but I understand you. And then we're in a wholly different place. So I think that can be helpful. Also, to coordinate multiplicity rather than trying to find a singular answer. How do we, you know, and I think I addressed that a little bit with, you know, how we can have tolerance for difference in your previous question to me. And I think that there are just lots of things, like, to instead of focusing on the past, focus on the future, because the future hasn't been constructed yet. And the past, you know, invites us into this causal logic. You did this, so therefore that, you know, but what can we do together going forward is a much more generative kind of discussion to have, and helps us to build community, I think. And then also to engage in reflexive dialogue, you know, sort of questioning ourselves. Like, this is something that I do all the time. Every time I feel like, oh, I've got the answer, this inner voice says, really? Is there, like, no other way you could think about this? And I think that that's really important for all of us to have that humility. And also the notion of relational reflexivity, to you know, stop and ask the people we work with in a therapeutic context. Am I asking you the right questions? Is this useful to you? What might be more useful, et cetera, et cetera. So I think that all of those things are helpful to us in just trying to, you know, break through these really difficult times that we face now.
Yeah, that was great. Thank you. And I'd like to maybe add one more. You've spoken about, and this is for all the therapists and counselors and social workers listening, you've spoken about doubt being useful and holding on to when we think we know the answer about somebody seeking our help. And I'm wondering if you could say more about that.
Yeah, I for me, that's so critical because, you know, we live in a world where certainty is privileged, and the person who knows is the one who gets the credit or gets the promotion or whatever. And, you know, it requires a lot of humility to say, oh, I've got an answer, and then be able to say, but maybe it's not so good. You know, maybe my suggestion isn't the best. And so to entertain doubt about our own certainty, to me, is so critical. And it's not easy to do in today's world, mm-hmm. particularly in today's political climate. Mm-hmm. But if we entertain doubt about our own certainty, we open ourselves to, for example, being able to actually have a genuine conversation with someone with completely oppositional political beliefs. But if, you know, even if they hold on to their certainty, if you just keep questioning and have genuine curiosity, not feigned curiosity, if you really want to listen and give them the space, you can change the dynamic of that interaction. And so I think, yes, entertaining doubt is really critical for all of us.
Yeah. And with that, and you spoke about this just recently a little bit, can you share more about how you, because I think this is so important. I'm wondering if you could share more about how you use relational reflexivity, because I think that's becoming a lost art as well.
Mm. You know, the thing about relational reflexivity is that it very quickly can make you look like you're not a professional, right? So let's take it in a therapeutic context.
For sure.
If you say, hey, are the questions I'm asking you useful? You know, and a client could respond by saying, you're the therapist, you're the expert, why are you asking me that question? Mm-hmm, so mm-hmm. It's really hard, and it takes a lot of humility to engage in relational reflexivity. But I think, you know, I think about with my students, my undergraduate students, I try to engage in that, and they throw it back like, you're the professor, you tell us. But eventually they come, you know, I explain why I'm asking these kinds of questions, and then they become engaged, and they realize that together we are creating, like, a seminar isn't a bad seminar. It's what we're doing isn't working well. We can make it better, you know? And so I think relational reflexivity is really critical. It's so useful, but it's so odd to people, mm-hmm. you know, particularly in the culture we live in, where experts are experts and experts are supposed to know. So why are you asking me? You're the expert. Mm-hmm. So I think that there are some maybe more subtle ways that we can invite people in. And so it doesn't make it look like we're saying, oh, I have no idea what I'm doing here. You know?
Yeah, right. Yeah. That's great. Thank you. Okay, I have one last question for you. I'm always interested. What ideas or books or work is capturing your interest currently? What's on your radar?
Yeah, that's a really great question, because I find myself, in the past couple of years, I've kind of gone in this direction that is completely coherent for me with my work, but completely out of, you know, not directly coming from the therapeutic literature or the literatures I usually draw on. So I have been really taken by Bruce Alexander's work on addiction. Mm. But it's not just because it's about addiction. It's because and then Johann Hari has kind of popularized Bruce Alexander's work. So I put them in the same category, because the main message is that, you know, addiction isn't a chemical dependency. Addiction is about isolation.
Right.
And that puts us like right smack in the center of what we are all about, talking about, you know, relational processes, building community, all the things that we have lost, not completely, but, you know, yeah. are being threatened now. And so I find that argument, I use both of their works in my seminars, and not to talk about addiction, but to talk about, you know, other all issues. Mm. And then this is interesting because he's politically shifted, but David Brooks' new book, The Second Mountain, where he's basically also saying that the argument is that, you know, we climb this first mountain and it's all about me, 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 me. And then, you know, we get to the top and we say, is this all there is? Mm. Or we get thrown off the mountain because of all sorts of things that happen. And that the second mountain is a mountain about community, about relationships and so forth. It's an interesting read. It's not the best book in the world, but the argument I think is, you know, it's nice to see, particularly people who have been identified as political conservatives, you know, kind of coming around to see this, the significance of relational approaches.
Right.
And I'm waiting for a new book that hasn't come yet called McMindfulness, because it is, you know, given where we started, and I said, you know, the radical presence is like a reaction to this mindfulness stuff. And it turns out that this guy, Ronald Purser, seems to have written a book that I should have written.
Yeah, you should have. I've actually read some of his stuff earlier. I think it's probably some of the stuff that was the formation of the book. But yeah, very very critical of how mindfulness is being co-opted in various ways, right?
Yeah, I really am eager to see that, because it's been, you know, my argument for so long. And that's those are the things that, you know, I've been reading now.
That's wonderful. Thank you for sharing that. And once again, Sheila, thank you for that. This has been wonderful, just a wonderful mix of theory and practice. And so thank you for that. And I just want to say thank you for making the time and being on the show.
Thank you, Chris. It's really been great. It's nice to meet you, too.
Yeah, finally. Thanks.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Okay, that's our show. And as always, thanks for listening. Please share it around with people you think might find it valuable. And if you would be so kind, please leave or rate and review the show. And if you're on iTunes, rate and review the show. That's what they tell me, how we can get out in front of more people. So that would be very much appreciated. I have stickers and I have t-shirts. Shh, don't tell anybody. I have t-shirts. So if you're interested in either of those, please shoot me an email at theradicaltherapist@gmail.com. Go find us on social media and Facebook at The Radical Therapist, on Twitter at The Rad Therapist, and like I said earlier, on Instagram at The Radical Therapist, and come be part of the community. That would be appreciated. So, as always, my name is Dr. Chris Hoff. This has been The Radical Therapist Podcast. Thanks for listening.